First of all, I want to extend the words of welcome and the announcements just for a moment. It's appropriate. The last time I did a series of sermons, as we're doing now, on the church was in August of 1989, just before we actually launched our first morning service. The last time I did a series of sermons on the church. And that's what we're doing right now. And the reason is because we're at actually the most strategic and crucial time in our life since we began Redeemer. In the Old Testament, the people of God are continually called to covenant renewal times. A covenant renewal is going back to the original calling, the original commitment, and renewing the commitment. And there's always something old because it's covenant renewal, you know, but it's also something new, which because it's covenant renewal. And what we're doing at this time, over the next three weeks, is we are trying to marshal and mobilize our people to recommit ourselves to the vision of Redeemer, which in 1989 we said was this: we're not here so much to build up our church as to build up our city. And though God has really honored that commitment a great deal, and you can see, look at everybody here, we are making a change. We are going to reach our vision, we're recommitting to our vision, but we're reorganizing. And we're seeking to begin two new structures. The first is, we are going to become a church that meets, first of all, on the west side as well as the east side, but we're going to become a church of multiple sites, a single congregation meeting many places. So we combine both the strengths of smaller worshiping communities with the strengths of a very large church. And the second structure is, we are going to form an urban church development center so that Redeemer at last can use what we've learned to serve New York and other churches and other cities by planting hundreds of new churches in New York and other cities. In order to do that, the people of Redeemer are going to have to step up into heavier leadership responsibilities and to greater financial commitment. So over the next 3 weeks, you're going to be getting, in order to understand what this covenant renewal is, you're going to be getting several pieces of literature, most of which, every word I have written, they're really for me, though very heavily edited by some people who I will not name. Incredible numbers of passive constructions have been edited out of my words, but they're my words, and they're all coming to you. And what I'm going to be, listen, you're going to get a lot of information, and I am personally begging you to read every word of it. For 3 weeks, 22 days, it climaxes March 22nd, you're going to hear about the needs, you're going to hear about the vision, you're going to hear about the way to give to it, and you've never gotten any kind of blitz like this before, and you never will again. Why? I do not apologize. For these 3 weeks, and it's not very long, this is a unique time in the history of our church. We're going to talk about these things so that you all have ownership, so you know what it is, so you can be involved. Most churches, when they raise a capital funds, several million dollars, they do it to get a building to establish one good gospel-centered church. For the very same amount of money, we're offering you an opportunity to create a structure that would actually establish hundreds of gospel-spreading churches. Same amount. So it's really, in some ways, a no-brainer. It's a tremendous opportunity. But in order to understand it, in order to have a no-brainer, you have to use your brain. So therefore, I ask personally that you'll read every word that comes. Okay? Thank you. Now, let's continue with this series on the church. And today we read this passage out of the book of Acts. Acts 20. This is Paul, talking about Paul. And when he, that's St. Paul, when he had said this, he knelt down with all of them and prayed. They all wept as they embraced him and kissed him. What grieved them most was his statement that they would never see his face again. And then they accompanied him to the ship. After we had torn ourselves away from them, we put out to sea and sailed straight to Kos. The next day we went to Rhodes and from there to Patara, and we found a ship crossing over to Phoenicia and went on board and set sail. After sighting Cyprus and passing to the south of it, we sailed on to Syria. We landed in Tyre, where our ship was to unload its cargo. Finding the disciples there, we stayed with them 7 days. Through the Spirit, they urged Paul not to go to Jerusalem. But when our time was up, we left and continued on our way. All the disciples and their wives and children accompanied us out of the city, and there on the beach, we knelt to pray. After saying goodbye to each other, we went aboard the ship and they returned home. We continued our voyage from Tyre and landed at Ptolemais, where we greeted the brothers and stayed with them for a day. Leaving the next day, we reached Caesarea and stayed at the house of Philip the Evangelist, one of the seven. Let's end right there. Now, every single week, we're looking at another aspect, another trait or characteristic of the church as Jesus designed it to be. And we're doing this not just because of this covenant renewal time in the life of our church, but also because anybody here, anybody listening, if you want to know anything about Jesus, there's almost no better way to do it than to see what he designed his church to be. There's almost no better way to know who he is or what he calls you to be, except by looking at what he says the church should be. Now, all the traits we're looking at are actually listed in Acts chapter 2, and one of these weeks I'll actually get out the list and go over them. But the one we're looking at today, as soon as we come to it, we have a problem with the English language. Because the trait we want to look at today is mentioned in chapter 2 of Acts, verse 42, where it talks about the early church, and it says, they devoted themselves to fellowship. Fellowship. That's what we want to talk about today, Christian fellowship. Right away, we have a problem. Because the word has been so trivialized and debased. And when you think of fellowship, you think of punching cookies in the fellowship hall. You think of touring the Holy Land in a bus with the Sunday school class, and we're having great fellowship. And because the word has been so debased, people nowadays like to talk about, they use a different word for it, they talk about Christian community. And that's a much better word. That the experience of Jesus Christ, the gospel, creates Christian community. But today I'd like to use another word that's not really better, but it's a bit different, and I think it'll be a little more challenging and maybe even a little more practical. What the Bible teaches us is that the gospel of Jesus Christ creates and calls us into spiritual friendships. I got this word from a 12th century book by Aelred of Rivaux, an English monk. It's a very, very helpful book. Spiritual friendships. In other words, the gospel of Jesus Christ does not simply send you deeper into the heart of God than you ever thought you would go, or deeper into the heart of the hurting world than you ever thought you would go, but it sends you deeper into the heart of other brothers and sisters in Christ, giving you profundity and intimacy of relationships beyond anything you ever thought was possible with any other human being. That's what we're taught. And all I want to do is to show you that in this very strange travelogue, as I read it through, when you got done, did you say, and? I mean, when you read this, you say, what is this about? This is just a travelogue. This is, what is this? What's going on here? But in the travelogue, this is all about friendship. And even though there's way too many principles to bring out, I'm going to give you four. Four extremely important principles of spiritual friendship that we need before we go to the table, because the Lord's Supper is the perfect place to think about this. According to the Bible, spiritual friendships, according to this passage, I should say, there's four principles. Spiritual friendships are needed, discovered, made, and forever. They're needed, they're discovered, not just made, they're made, not just discovered, and they're forever. Number one. First thing is, they're needed. Something is happening in Paul's life here, and you don't really get the picture of it unless you read the whole book of Acts, but let me give you the context. Starting here, Paul's life changes forever. All the rest of his life becomes one crushing trouble after another. Before this point, Paul's sort of in charge of his life. He makes his goals, he goes out, and he does all these missionary journeys. But in chapter 20, verse 21, we didn't read it, it's up a little earlier. In chapter 20, verse 21, Paul says that the Spirit of God had shown him that he needs to go to Jerusalem. And he knows if he goes to Jerusalem, he'll be arrested and imprisoned, and that's exactly what happens. And in the rest of his life, it's just one trial after another trial, a narrow escape, an attack, his life is in danger, one more narrow escape, and he's totally out of control. His life is one more crushing trouble after another. And starting here, you will see that he spends an enormous amount of time with friends. Look carefully. Everywhere he goes, he's surrounded by his friends. They walk with him to the beach. They walk with him. He's spending hours and hours and hours weeping and discussing and talking and arguing, as we're going to see. On and on and on. suddenly he begins to swim in friends. And what does this tell us? Here's the first lesson. To need and to want deep friendships is not a sign of spiritual immaturity, but of maturity. It's not a sign of weakness, it's a sign of health. When Adam was created in Genesis 2, we have one of the great theological weirdnesses in the Bible. Because chapter 3 is when sin enters the world, and all bad things happen from Genesis 3 on. All the bad things. But in Genesis 1 and 2, we see humanity before the fall, before sin, when everything is great. And as a result, all the way through those first two chapters, we see God saying, it is good, it is good, it is good, it is good, but suddenly we get to one thing before sin comes into the world, which is not good. One thing that God says is not good, that Adam is alone. Now here's what this means. Adam was not lonely because he was imperfect, but because he was perfect. The ache for friends is the one ache that is not the result of sin. Every other ache, every other longing that Adam ever had, that human beings ever had, the hunger ache, the sickness ache, the guilt ache, see, the lack of meaning in life ache, they all come from sin. This is one ache that's a good, this is one ache that is part of his perfection. Adam could not even enjoy the paradise. God made us in such a way that we cannot enjoy paradise without friends. God made us in such a way that we cannot enjoy our joy without friends. Human friends. Adam had a perfect quiet time every day. 24 hours, you see. Never had a dry one. And yet he needed. Now, what is this? Let's practically apply this. Number one, if you are lonely, if you want more friends, if you want closer friends, if you feel lonely, you are not dysfunctional, you are fine. You're lonely because you're not a tree. You're lonely because you're not a machine. You're lonely because you're built this way. That's the first point. Now, I'm going to show you in a second that one of the reasons why you're lonely, and I have to be careful about this. Let's do a little self-analysis. One of the reasons why you're lonely is because you want friends. One of the reasons you want friends is because you don't have many friends. One of the reasons you don't have friends may be because of sin, because of flaws, because of mistakes you're making. But the passion for it, the need for it, the sense of lack is not wrong at all. That's first. Secondly, let me apply this. I hope you know who you are. Some of you have learned or are learning through semi-conscious decisions not to want or need friends. Now, there's all kinds of reasons why this happens. Some of you may have, if you live in New York City for more than 4 or 5 years, it's a tremendous temptation. So many people have moved away, you start to say, I don't want to get started again. It's also an age problem. As you get older, you realize how much time friends take. Or just the fact of living in the world, people let you down, people disappoint you, people hurt you. And so I would suggest that almost always it's semi-conscious. Very seldom do you say, I am not going to need people anymore. Sometimes you do that, but generally you don't do that. But I hope you see that an awful lot of us are doing that right now, and I beg you not to. I say it's hard on your heart, it's wrong. You see, the less you want people, the less you want friends, the less like God you are, the less like Jesus you are. If you read, one of the things that amazes me, Paul wasn't the only tremendously strong, great person who desperately needed friends. There was a greater one. And he had 12 friends, and they never understood him, and they continually let him down, and they were always hurting his feelings. And yet, if you read the Gospels, you'll see one of the reasons why the Gospels are so full is because he was constantly sharing his thoughts and his deepest hearts with his friends who didn't even get it until after Pentecost. I mean, take a look. You know, I was just reading the other day. Here's in Luke chapter 12, what does Jesus say? He says, I have a baptism, a fire to undergo, and how distressed I am until it happens. I mean, what is he doing? He's always thinking out loud. He's always sharing his thoughts. He's always saying, would you please come and pray with me? If you don't need people, if you're afraid of accountability, if you're afraid of people looking inside, if you're afraid of people nosing into your business, if you're afraid of needing, if you're afraid of love, The less you want friends, the less like God you are. Don't you realize what is the purpose of creation? And what was the purpose of redemption? What is the purpose of everything God has done since creation? To make us friends. See, if you decide, I think it's just not worth it, I'm not going to need people, look what you've done to yourself. Look what you're doing to yourself. One more thing. One lastly. Please, friends, let yourself need people. And here's the trouble. When you're in trouble, it's too late. You know, very few people walk around saying, I love air. Oh, air. Air. What good is my brain without air? It wouldn't work without air. What good is this food without air? It wouldn't work. You don't walk around saying, air, oh my gosh, air. What good would any of my life be with it? No, you only start to feel that way about air when you're underwater. Then you start to say, wow, air. I mean, you know, boy. And you don't walk around saying, I need friends, usually until you emotionally and personally go under. And then it's too late. If you don't have them, if they're not there, spiritual friendships, you need them. Secondly, spiritual friendships are discovered, not just made. Now, one of the things that I would never have known, and you wouldn't either unless you'd read the commentators, but the people who know something about history and background and the original languages and all that, the people who write commentaries point out something, that when Paul gets to Tyre, he's getting to a church that he did not plant. He's getting to a church that he did not start. He's getting to a place where he's meeting Christians that probably he's never met before. And they feel that it is their right to rise up and to say, Paul, you're all wrong, to confront him, to urge him through the Spirit not to go to Jerusalem, to get involved with his life and to get involved in his decision making. And astonishingly, and of course I couldn't print all the rest of the chapter, if you watch very carefully, you'll see, astonishingly, Paul lets them. He doesn't say, how dare you? This is part of it. The point is, people that you have no natural affinity with, if you share Jesus Christ with them, there is a bond that exerts itself. Now, in a sense, even the pagans understood this. If you read one of the greatest works that was ever written on friendship, is written by Cicero, a pagan Greek, or Roman, I guess, philosopher. And even in our own day, we have people like Emerson who wasn't a Christian, but they understood this, and that is that the very essence of friendship is not to look at each other, but to look at something in common. What makes you a friend is not that you're kneeling before each other saying, dude, don't you want to be in a relationship with me? What makes friends friends is that you're both kneeling before something else. The essence of friendship is to say, not do you love me, but do you love the same truth? What makes friendship happen is not that you're looking at each other and saying, how's our relationship? But you're looking at something that has captured your heart. So even the pagans understood this, that friends cannot be made out of nothing. They can't be made out of nothing. There has to be some common passion, some common adoration. But you see, with Christianity, we've got an incredible possibility. Look twice. Paul kneels and prays. And right there, you've got a physical picture of spiritual friendship. If you're both kneeling before the same God, if you're both adoring the same God, that pulls you together in astounding ways. Over and over the Bible says, the most formative possible experience you can have is an experience of the grace of Jesus Christ. And when that comes in, this is what's so great. There's a friendship bond that is exerted. I even use the word automatic, though I'm going to show you have to work with it. It says in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 2 and 3, it says, maintain the spirit of unity in the bond of peace. It doesn't say attain the spirit of unity in the bond of peace. Maintain. You can't attain it. You can't create it. You can be a steward of it, but it comes. It's a gift. And it's there when two people fall in love with Jesus Christ, they are becoming friends, no matter who they used to be. Did you hear right? When two people become friends, they start to fall in love with Jesus Christ, they're kneeling before him, they are becoming friends no matter who they used to be. This is beginning to happen at Redeemer. Look at your uniforms. We all have to have uniforms. We're all part of some human community. Look at the way you're dressed. Look at the way you're made up. Look at the way you look. There's uptown uniforms. There's downtown uniforms. There's corporate uniforms. There's creative uniforms. There's homeboys. There's valley girls. There's preppies. There's yuppies. And you got to be something. Well, I'm not anything. Well, then you're probably a nerd. But Tom Wolfe, some years ago, wrote this great story about the fact that when the Vatican brought their treasures to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you have to have a kind of supper. You have to have a big meal at the Met. And the people who have brought... So the trouble was, the people who brought the art were priests. So the Met had to do it. They brought all the glitterati. You know, the glitterati, the people who run the museums, the people of the art world, the people who are successful in the art world, you see, the glitterati. And they had them sit down, and at the meal, they were seated like this. Glitterati, priest, glitterati, priest, glitterati, priest. And Tom Wolfe said, at one point, a couple of them did get out to go to the bathroom or something, and on the way back in, one was heard to say to the other one, "My God, who are these people?" And you see, that's New York. We see each other on the streets, but we live absolutely parallel lives. We would never want to know somebody who wears that kind of tie. But when Christ happens, you know what's going on? You don't, if you're a glitterati, you don't stop dressing chic, but you're not kneeling before chicness anymore. You're not kneeling down and worshiping chicness. You're kneeling down and worshiping Jesus Christ, and that makes you a brother or a sister with the nerdiest nerd who loves and is kneeling before the same thing. It means that there's a bond there that you don't have with your what used to be your own people. You're a Christian first, and you're anything else second. It doesn't matter who your ancestors was. It doesn't matter your race. It doesn't matter your experience. It doesn't matter whether you've been through Vietnam or World War II or the Depression or the divorce culture. It doesn't matter your age. Spiritual friendship is discovered first. Now I got to move on. See, in other words, there are possibilities for getting on inside the Christian church with people, between people, friendships that outside the Christian church would be impossible anywhere else. And the Bible over and over again, I don't have time to go into it now, says that this is the test that you have experienced grace. If you've experienced grace, you find yourself not just sort of getting along, but coming to love people that before you would have never wanted to even spend a moment with. Never. That's one of the ways you know that something's happened to you. And if it isn't happening to you, and you can't give me a list, what's it mean? Here, let me make this application. This is one of the reasons, this second principle, that friendships happen. They're not something you can create de novo. And they come from what you're in love with. And they happen with people who are most in love with the same thing you're in love with. As a result of that, this is one of the reasons why a lot of people have very few friends. C.S. Lewis, in his book, Four Loves, puts it this way. He says, if you want nothing but approval, if you want nothing but friends, you'll never have friends, because friendship is always about something besides friends. He's got this great spot in his book, which explains why some people, and probably some people right here, find that they don't have much in the way of friends. He says, that is why those pathetic people who simply want friends can never make any. The very condition for having friends is that we should want something else besides friends. If someone asks you, do you see the same truth? And the honest answer is, I don't care about that, I just want you to be my friend. Then no real friendship can possibly arise. There would be nothing for the friendship to be about. Those who have nothing can share nothing. Those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers. But let me get it down to Christianity. One of the reasons why you don't have more friends is because your friendship with God isn't passionate. Because you're not kneeling on the beach. Because His love is not just overwhelming you. One of the reasons why people come to certain folks and open up is because there's a poise, there's a peace, there's a love, there's a joy, there's a vitality that comes from their friendship with God. You're not attractive unless you have friendship with God. Here's the great irony. Make friendship with God more important than friendship with people. Get in with God more than you want to get in with people, and people will come and want to get in with you. Spiritual friendship is discovered, not just made. Then thirdly, spiritual friendship is made, not just discovered. Now, somebody says, isn't that a contradiction? No, it's a tension. But if you look here, you will see that these friendships take a tremendous amount of work. In a sense, the gospel gives you the raw material. I mean, you artists know this, you sculptors, God gives you the raw material. But then you have an awful lot to do with it. And if you look carefully, you know, the word koinonia, that Greek word that is always translated fellowship in the Bible, is actually means to share. Now take a look. Look with me and see, if you want friendships, you have to share. You have to share. Look, number one, they share their feelings. Look at on the beach the first time. They wept. They kissed. They embraced. Guys. You can't be a Christian. You cannot have spiritual friendship unless you share your feelings. Secondly, they shared their things. Did you notice that Paul was staying with people? Hospitality. People opened their homes. People fed him. You can't be friends unless you're willing to share your things. Thirdly, they share their faith. They're constantly talking about the Lord. They're constantly talking about the gospel. They're constantly praying. There's this great place in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 13, that says, exhort one another daily, lest ye be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. The word exhort is one of the Greek words for preach. And it says, you have got to have people in your life that are so close to you that you and they can, you can preach the gospel to each other. You've got to have friends to preach the gospel to you, or you will be deceived. Your heart will automatically harden, lest you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. You are not, it's not spiritual friendship unless you're preaching the gospel to each other, unless you have got some people in your life that you authorize to press you sometimes. And that leads to number four. They share their feelings, they share their, things, they share their faith, they're sharing the decision. Now here's what's fascinating. They say in verse 4 that the Spirit had given them enough insight as to say, if you go to Jerusalem, that's going to be the end of your missionary career, and they urge him not to go. But if you go back to chapter 20, verse 21, you'll see that Paul says the Spirit told him to go. Now, some people get very confused about this, but only for this reason. What is fascinating is if you read along a little further, and I guess I better read it to it for a little further, they keep arguing with him. And at one point it says, when we heard this, we and the people were pleading with Paul not to go up to Jerusalem. This is verse 12. And then Paul answered, why are you weeping and breaking my heart? I am ready not only to be bound, but also to die for the Lord Jesus. And when he would not be dissuaded, we gave up and said, the Lord's will be done. Notice, they didn't say, the Spirit told us you shouldn't go. You are disobeying the Spirit. And he didn't say, look, the Spirit told me I have to go, so why are we having this discussion? Any view of the Spirit's guidance in your life that is so mechanistic, it leaves out the process of friendship, of iron sharpening iron, of really being open to each other. Anybody who doesn't understand that doesn't understand the power of Christian friendship. We are never allowed to make our decisions by ourselves. There is no unilateral decision making going on. Paul never says, mind your own business. He doesn't even say that to Christians he hardly even knows, like in Tyre. You're not a friend unless you let people into your business and unless you stop being self-accredited. You're not a friend unless if you can continually come and say, the Lord said and you have to obey what I'm telling you. But you're also not a friend if you refuse to let people come and say, I just think you're absolutely wrong. You've got to listen. You have to share decisions. Okay? One more thing. You have to share your time. Every other kind of love besides friend love will push itself on you because it's a biological or sociological necessity. Romantic love will be pushed on you by your hormones. Family love will be pushed on you by your family. Citizenship love will be pushed on you by your country. I didn't want to do jury duty. And when it was done, I said, boy, it's great to be here working with my fellow citizens to try to make this a more just place. But it was forced on me. But nobody will force you on this. And friendship love, because there is no biological or sociological necessity, would take a lot more time. It's being squeezed out. You've got to share your time. You've got to share your heart. You've got to share your life. But there's one more thing. I had to read this thing 20 times before I saw it. Look at the word we. Who's we? Paul has said, if I go to Jerusalem, I'm going to probably be executed. And everybody else says, if we go to Jerusalem, you know, he's probably going to be imprisoned and executed. But Luke goes ahead. He's going to Jerusalem with him. Why would you do something as stupid as that? Especially when you had some doubt that he was right. because that's friendship. As Aylred says, in worldly friendship, you really aren't loving people for their sake, you're using them. See, whenever you find yourself loving somebody because it makes you feel good about yourself because it's a slick person, or loving somebody because this person is giving a lot of approval, or loving somebody because they're listening to you and they're eating, you know, out of your hand, but then when the person becomes stupid in your mindset, or stops approving you, or actually becomes actually more of a drain, and if you say, then I've had it with you, you never loved them to start with. You loved the love you were getting. You were using them. If a person who always seems to need you suddenly starts to get strong and you don't want to be their friend anymore, you needed their needing of you. Luke is committed. A friend shares commitment. A friend shares life. A friend says, I'll be there thick or thin. And if you do all these things, built on that original thing that God has there in Christ, you will have the most powerful, the deepest friendships and relationships you could possibly ever have. One last thing. Friendships are forever. Now, I'll tell you where I get that from. You have to read the whole book of Acts. You have to understand the narrative. You have to understand the flow. But Luke is again and again showing Christians saying goodbye. Goodbye. You'll never see me again. Goodbye. You'll never see me again. And yet there's a poise, and yet there's a peace, and that's the reason. Here's the reason why. No other religion believes that friendships last. You see, they don't really believe that. Eastern religions say when you die, you go into impersonality. Secularism says, when you die, you rot. And even religions that believe only in a God, they don't believe in the Trinity. They believe God used to always exist. And then when he created human beings or angels, then he started having relationships. But Christian God is triune. If you go back to Proverbs 8, and you will see, it talks about the Father and the Son, God and wisdom, delighting in each other as they created the world. The Bible says that relationships and friendships were the reason we were built. Our creation is the result of friendships, and our destiny is eternal friendship. You know, there's a very, very awful but wonderful folk song. It was written many years ago, and you can tell. You've heard songs like this. It's about a woman who's sitting on the beach. And this is it's an American folk song. It goes like this. Oh, where is my sailor boy? Where is my sailor boy? He sleeps at the bottom of the deep blue sea, and he can't come back to me. She stood on the beach at dawn and gazed at the misty blue, saying, see, as you hold him to your breast, does he mention my name to you? Oh, please tell me, deep blue sea, is he sleeping peacefully? While the winds of the north are blowing icy cold, can you keep him warm for me? If only my grieving soul some token of love could find, if only the waves would tell me where he sleeps, I would leave this world behind. Okay, here's a woman, and her love or her husband has been drowned. And she talks to the sea as if it's a person. And she thinks of him not as chemicals, but as still there. Somebody she wants to relate to. And she yearns for the idea of eternal friendship. But the chorus, every time, it's a great song because of the chorus, every time it says this. But what does the deep sea say? What does the deep sea say? It moans and groans and splashes and foams and rolls on its weary way. You know why? Because the sea isn't personal. The sea can't keep him. The sea can't hold on to him. The sea can't keep him warm at night. The sea can't keep him until she gets there. So she's on the beach, and she's the answer of the sea. I don't care. And yet when Jonathan Edwards was dying, and his wife was far away in Stockbridge. He was down in Princeton. This is back in the 1750s. He dictated a letter to his wife through his daughter, Lucy. And this is what he said. Give my kindest love to my dear wife and tell her that the uncommon union which has so long subsisted between us has been of such a nature as I trust is spiritual and therefore will continue forever. It's two people kneeling on the beach. Behind the sea is a heart. All creation was about making us friends. All redemption is about keeping us, remaking us friends. And therefore, Christianity says, life is about friendship. Go get it. Now, as we go to the Lord's Supper, here's what I suggest you do. Here's what we're going to do. This is a perfect time because the Lord's Supper is all about unity. Where do you see what we're singing? First of all, I suggest if any of you have a friendship to repair, this is the time to do it. If you know you've done something wrong, if you know that you just have got to swallow your pride and go to somebody and make the friendship up, it is traditional. In fact, Jesus even suggests it. He says, if you know that you've got something between you and a friend, leave your gift at the altar and go. Now, what this is a way of saying this, fast. In ancient days, they used to always say, I will not eat or drink until I get something done. Okay. If you want to really, really make a promise, don't take the Lord's Supper until you get your friend back. Abstain so that you can actually kind of strengthen your heart for it. And don't think of it as a failure. It's a success. You have a friendship to repair? Do that. Secondly, some of you need to just, in general, get rid of all of the hurt feelings and the fussiness. And all, you know, our friendships are supposed to be about Jesus, not about, do you like me? How well do you like me? There shouldn't be all this intrigue. There shouldn't be all this awful self-consciousness. It wasn't long ago that a friend of mine, who I've known for a long time, called me up and said, you know what? For years I've been upset that I call you 5 times for every time you call me. And then I began to realize that our lives have gone differently. I'm a private person and you're much more of a public person, and I want you to know I'm glad you're my friend. And he took all this off of me. Because what he was saying is, what was he doing at that point? He was getting rid of the intrigue. He was getting rid of all that the self-consciousness. He was starting to say, I'm full because Jesus Christ is my friend. I can love you better because I don't need you so badly. And you need to do that. Some of you, during the Lord's Supper, take the Lord's Supper, but at the same time say, this is the strength of my friendship with you so that I can strengthen my friendship with other people. And some of you, by the way, who are married, need to ask God, show me how to make my spouse my best friend again. Or maybe for the first time. Oh, make this Lord's Supper about friendship. Friendship with Him. Friendship with each other. Let's pray.